Hello and welcome to this course. In this first segment, we're going to talk about some introductory questions. First of all, the question that we are dealing with literature, we're dealing with something that people wrote a long time ago. And when you write anything, even if you're writing a letter to a friend or you're writing a letter home, you have a certain perspective. We call this a bias. It's the perspective from which you write. And it might have to do with the relationship you have with the people you're writing to. It certainly has to do with your context, with your situation, where you are. And it also has to do with who we are from the beginning of our lives, the whole formation of who we are. And so we can refer to that as a literary bias. And everybody who is writing any of these texts that we're going to look at, including biblical texts, especially biblical texts, also has that perspective, that bias from which they come. And so every time we read an old text, an ancient text, or even a modern text, we have to be aware of the perspective from which the author comes, which might not be the same as our own perspective, huh? So that's really what we mean by a literary bias. And we have to be aware of that in the interpretation of texts. And what we're going to do in this course is to look at a number of texts that have to do with women in the early church. Unfortunately, we don't have anything really, with one small exception, one possible small exception, that's actually written by any of these women, but they are texts written about the women and about what they do and about how they minister, how they serve in their churches. And so these are texts that we're going to look at, and as with any text, we have to look at what's the perspective from which the author is coming. Now, a second point is about what I call social disparities, now and then. So we've looked at bias, we talked about literary bias, now we're talking about social bias. So what I mean by that is the way the society is constructed. And we're going to talk more about that in detail as we get into some of the later segments, because we're going to look at various groups of people in the ancient society, the ancient Mediterranean Roman society, that produced these biblical texts. In this case, we're looking at New Testament, but we're going to look at other texts that come from pretty much the same society within a range of about 300 years. And the social disparities then were perhaps even greater than the ones in which so many of us live. And I'm aware that the people watching this will come from all different kinds of contexts, from different countries and different social levels, men and women, and that in every case we have our own perspective and our own particular situation to deal with, whether that is a situation that is freeing for us or that is oppressive. So when we talk about social disparities, we have to be aware of how things are different for different people. We talk today in many circles about inequality, about growing social and economic inequality that is happening all over the world. And economists and social scientists are very aware of this. Well, in this ancient society in which these people lived and worked, there was also a great deal of social disparity. Some of it built in in a formal way, such that is perhaps different from most of our experience today. And so there were recognizable differences in social class. And some of the people we're going to talk about toward the end of the course, when we get into the 4th and 5th centuries, are from the very top of the social ladder. They are the elites. They were fabulously wealthy. Those are the people whose voices we hear. They survived. They had the ability to write about their experience. And one of the challenges when we're looking at something like ancient Mediterranean society in which the New Testament came to be, one of the things that we try to do is to try to find the voices of the other people. And as we move through the course, I think you'll see more of what I mean by that. Now, the third point is the possibility of retrieving women's voices. And I already said, we only have one possible exception of a woman actually writing, and that is Perpetua in the very well-known martyrdom account of the Acts of Perpetua and Felicitas. There is a point in that narrative in which the narrator, the person who's telling the story, says, well, now I'm going to let Perpetua speak in her own words. And so you have a different voice going on there. And I think that it is, in fact, something written by this woman, Perpetua, because we know she was well-educated. However, some others doubt that. Some scholars say it's just... It's a literary turn in which someone else pretends to be her voice. But we'll look at that another time. So, except for that, we don't have literature actually written by women. We have literature in which women appear, in which there are women whose names we know. If you think of the Gospels, for example, there are a number of women, and we will examine them and their role in a future segment. But we know names of women. From the Pauline letters, we know names of women. And in the case of the Pauline letters, surely real women to whom or about whom Paul is writing. But we don't hear from those women themselves. We don't have the voices of the women. For example, Paul in 1 Corinthians 5, is talking about women prophets, and we don't have the voice of those women prophets answering back. No? So... that's a problem. We don't know how the women themselves received the things that are written about them because we don't have their response and their answer. Another problem is the assumption that when we have masculine plural words, we're only talking about men. Greek... In the language in which the New Testament and much of this early Christian literature was written is a gendered language. Words, nouns, and adjectives have gender. Adjectives, the gender of adjective has to agree with the noun. And so when you have references to groups of people, it will always be masculine plural. Unless it is specifically intended to say this group is composed only of women, and then it's feminine plural. So ordinarily, unless you're talking about specifically a group of women, and you know that because of the way the language is gendered, and it's going to be masculine plural. But a masculine plural can refer to a mixed group of men and women. And this is another case in which the women's voices are simply silent. So, it's problematic if we always think that when there is a masculine plural, that only men are present. Now, there's some interesting exceptions to that. In the introductions to Peter's preaching in the first chapters of Acts of the Apostles, he gets up and he says, Andres Adelphoi, literally, men, masculine people, brothers. And so there you get the idea that the author of Acts is saying, this is a group that's only composed of men. And yet, even in those situations, which are public places, there have to have been women there. I mean, we know from the way the economy worked that poorer women, lower class women, were out there selling their stuff, you know? I mean, there were women present, and their voices are really silent because they're not even recognized as members of the group. There are other situations, and I give two examples here. The word diakonos, and we're going to talk about that a lot later. Diakonos is a masculine word, which we usually translate deacon, and we'll talk about some of the levels of meaning of that word. But it's a masculine word. And yet, in Romans 16:1, Phoebe is called a diakonos. So a masculine word is applied to a woman. Phoebe is a woman's name. So one has to be careful not to assume that every time you get the word diakonos, that it's referring to a man, if it's uncertain. And the comparative example there, and we'll talk about that again later, is Philippians 1:1, where Paul is addressing the Philippian community with its episkopoi kai diakonoi. We'll talk about episkopos another time. But diakono, plural, masculine plural of diakonos. It's a mistake to assume that that refers only to men, because we have an example of a woman with that title in Romans 16:1. And the other example that I cite here, Romans 16:7, is Junia. Andronicus and Junia, whom Paul says are, first of all, they were either relatives or people from the same city as he. The word can mean either one. And they were in Christ before me, he says. So they were members of the Christian community before Paul, and they are noteworthy among the apostles. Now, there's a great deal of discussion about what that exactly means, but probably what it means is in the group of people who are known as apostles, they stand out. So in this case, you have Junia, a woman whose husband probably is Andronicus. It's probably another missionary couple like Prisca and Aquila. And they're apostles. So every time you get the reference to apostles, unless you're specifically referring to the 12 in the way that some of the Gospels set that up, Paul talks about apostles elsewhere in his letters. It's a mistake to assume that we're only talking about men. So this is a question of interpretation. To be careful about masculine plural words. The next point is the role of women in the New Testament, the role of women in the Pauline letters, the role of women, da-da-da-da. And what is a role? How do you understand what a role is? Is that a function? Is that, we talk about roles in movies, in drama, and that's playing a part. Is that the same thing that we mean here? And so that's a kind of an open question. And the problem with taking the role of women in such and such is you're looking at it in a kind of abstract way and not really dealing with the lives of the real women. So the idea of agency, there's a lot being talked about these days in examining the whole question of agency. What is agency? It's the ability to act in a way that assumes responsibility. Responsibility for the person. Responsibility for what you're doing. And that has been particularly examined in oppressive situations. When people are in situations in which they are not free to act the way they would like, for instance, in being imprisoned. How does a person assume any kind of autonomy, any kind of responsibility for who I am and what I do? And even in very oppressive situations, there are ways in which people find a freedom to act, a freedom to make a decision one way or another. There are all kinds of stories of people who have acted heroically in situations of oppression. Now, in the case of women, and women in this ancient world, which is what we're looking at, there were very defined roles, especially for upper-class women. How did they assume their own agency, their own personhood within those roles? And sometimes the study, and this is the bias of the interpreters now, the modern interpreters, is that they are not acting with any kind of agency if they remain within traditional roles, that only breaking out of those roles is an act of agency. And that's been re-examined now. And I think that there's much more awareness that that assuming a traditional role, taking it on, wanting it, loving it, is also an act of agency. So this is something we'll talk about more as we go. And finally, the problem with taking women as a special topic. Do you want to, when you're looking at a new book about early Christianity, do you want to find in the index women? What does that mean? If we have taken women out as a special topic, does that mean everything else is about men only? You see the problem there? So women are half of the human race, you know. So to treat women as a special topic, which we do need to do, but it still has its problems. Because then we're kind of saying, okay, well, then the rest of it is the world of men, except where you specifically have women. And that's not so, because the women are participating all the time in the regular life of the society. So those are some of the things that that I lay out as a beginning for this this adventure, this journey that we will be on together.